There was retaliation. All my ties with my business were over and I lost all of my income. What they said would happen to me happened to me. I mean, I was 52. I was like infected with this disease.
If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers, don't. Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two esoteric philosophers who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I am Megan Elizabeth.
And this week, our guest is Spencer Schneider, lawyer and author of Manhattan Cult Story, My Unbelievable True Story of Sex, Crimes, Chaos, and Survival. And unbelievable it is. He's going to talk to us about how at age 29 in New York City, he became friends with a man who introduced him to an esoteric school called School, a secret group of professionals that met every week to discuss ancient philosophies. He'll tell us about thinking it sounded like a cult, but going anyway, and what it was like when he finally met the leader, Sharon Gantz.
Give the man all the awards. We'll also discuss what class was like every week, all of the financial and psychological abuses he eventually discovered Sharon Gantz was perpetrating, and how he finally left after 23 years in the group.
His story is so fascinating and heartbreaking, and I have so many thoughts about it, but before we get into it with him, Megan, can you tell me what your cultiest thing is this week?
Sure. It's really sad, actually. And it's something we all know about. But to just see it in black and white today in the news was like, ooh, a few moms, too, in particular, are suing Meta and Instagram because their preteen daughters got on Instagram. And within 3 months, both had horrific eating disorders and tried to kill themselves.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Which, you know, I do understand as somebody who was dealing with those things myself when I was young and didn't have Instagram. I do understand that preteen is a very turbulent time in life, but 3 months to go that deep is not normal.
That is a very fast amount of time, but in teen years, that feels like a lifetime. I mean,
true.
I cannot imagine being a teenager in the age of Instagram.
It's horrifying.
I can barely be a 34-year-old in the age of Instagram. I actually deleted it from my phone because
it's horrible.
I just get obsessive about it. And I muted everyone actually who makes me feel insecure. So that's nice.
Oh, smart. That's a really good tip.
It is not a psychologically healthy environment, I would say, for your average teenage girl. It's so interesting too, because I think of eating disorders as a 90s thing.
Right.
Because that was the type of body we valued in the 90s was super skinny and then just huge fake tits or whatever. But now it's this almost even more unrealistic body shape, which is have a huge ass, but a tiny waist and a flat stomach. Which, who is going to have that body?
Well, unfortunately, also, it's about to get even crazier because the Kardashians all got their asses removed and lost 60 pounds and were like, LOL, you thought that we were body positive.
Wait, is this a confirmed thing?
Yeah.
I mean, I saw that Kim's butt looked smaller recently.
Yeah. And she's like, I lost 40 pounds and whatever, to fit in Marilyn Monroe's dress. And I'm like, oh my God, I know so many girls that were like, I'm supporting them because they're body positive. And now they've taken it back. I feel like Kate Moss is back in the headlines everywhere I look. Young people are sharing pictures of her because of the Johnny Depp shit. And I'm just like, ah, the cycle starts again. It's no longer high-rise jeans. Y'all don't understand that we did a service to humanity. And now it's low-rise jeans.
And that, high-rise jeans were a service to humanity. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
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 Low-rise jeans are a service to no one.
But asses are very much still the thing. Asses are not. It's just that they're this giant, exaggerated, obviously fake ass isn't cool anymore.
Exactly.
Which I think is a good thing. I don't think we should all be aspiring to have these ridiculous bedonks that no human would ever have.
That you had to get from surgery.
I love, and by love, I mean get sad when I see when there are certain people on the internet who will be like, my trainer got my booty big, and it's like, you so clearly got a Brazilian butt lift, and that's okay. I have been very tempted to get a Brazilian butt lift, but don't make people think that you can get that by working out, because that's just not real.
I wish their trainer would comment, LOL.
It's like, no, your entire body shape doesn't change that dramatically when you work out. I've talked to multiple trainers about this. This is not a thing, but they get, you know, you get so tricked, and because people are just fucking fake about it. This isn't even what this episode is about at all, but I would like to be transparent. I get fucking fillers in my face and I don't pretend that I don't, because that's stupid.
Yeah.
That's why I look young, guys.
What about you? What's the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
Oh gosh. People are so sick of hearing about OCD, but in my OCD journeys, one of the themes...
Part of your OCD is talking about OCD. I'm just kidding.
One of the themes that has threatened to take over has been like these existential obsessions and like thinking about death and you know, how every day that passes is just fleeting and we're all going to die, whatever. It's just like to an unusual degree because it's literally like it takes over my brain and it's all I can think about. Mm-hmm. So I decided to do an exposure. And what I did was go to a meeting held by death doulas. Do you know what a death doula is?
Cool, I do.
So for anyone who doesn't know, a death doula is the same as a doula for your baby, except for the dying and for the loved ones of the dying or the dead. It's part of a larger culture called the death positive movement. The basic idea is like we as a culture, particularly in America, hide from death. We don't want to see it. We want to get the bodies out right away. We want to pretend it's not there. We want to avoid it at all costs. What if we sat with it and let ourselves feel our feelings? And like, you know, if grandpa dies or whatever, instead of rushing him off to the morgue immediately, some people would put his body on dry ice and have people come and visit and just like grieve in a real way that actually deals with the fact that he's dead instead of trying to hide it away. Anyway, there are lots of different approaches. It's also just like you talk about it instead of avoiding. And so I went to this group where we just talked about death for an hour and it was amazing.
So I have a quick question. How did you guys deal with that in the Mormon church? Because how I was raised, we went to open casket funerals like every other week. It was death, 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 sit by the dead person, look at the dead person. Life is about dying, 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 dying. Did the Mormon church really stress that?
Well, not in any special way beyond any other group, I don't think. I only went to one funeral, I think, as a kid, which was my grandpa. Mm. And he wasn't Mormon. But there isn't like a particular Mormon ritual. It's just like general American, like you go to the funeral and it's, yes, it's open casket, but at least this used to be a thing where people didn't want to be cremated because they wanted their bodies to come back alive when Jesus came back.
I feel like once land started to get really expensive, everyone was like, just kidding. Jesus can figure it out.
I know. But yeah, but it wasn't like, it was never a thing. It wasn't about death. It was about the afterlife. The death was just like a blip on the way to the afterlife. So we didn't focus on it at all. And one of the things that one of the doulas talked to me about, and I actually might have him come on because he was amazing.
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah, but it is going from being a religious person talking about death to a non-religious person talking about death, because it's a completely different experience. Because one is like, oh, fuck, I have to contend with the fact that this is it.
Right.
Like, this is it. This might, or at least this might be it. There isn't heaven waiting for me and my family greeting me to guide me to the other side. Like, this might, I might just literally be in the ground and that might be the end of it. So it's like, it can be especially useful for non-religious people, almost like the way taking mushrooms is for people who are dying. It's like, become comfortable with the idea that this is the cycle of life and nature and the universe. And you may not persist as a spirit in heaven, but that's okay.
That is okay, yeah.
Okay, let's talk to Spencer.
Okay.
Welcome, Spencer Schneider. Thank you so much for coming on Trust Me.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ugh, so many questions for you. What a freaking fascinating story. So you are a lawyer and also an author of a new book called Manhattan Cult Story, My Unbelievable True Story of Sex, Crimes, Chaos, and Survival. What a title. Basically, you spent 23 years, right, in a secretive cult called School in New York. So can you please start us at the beginning and just tell us what your life was like before you got recruited?
Sure. I was and still am an attorney. I'm a New Yorker. I went to college in the Midwest, and then I came back to New York for law school, then started working for a big law firm and, you know, led the life of most lawyers working for big corporate law firms, which is, you know, working a lot of hours. I actually was in California for about a year, in San Jose, you know, that kind of disruption of your life, you know, it's kind of isolating, but I had everything I wanted, really. I was doing well and had plenty of friends and a stable life. There's nothing remarkable about my background that would indicate someone falling for a cult or anything like that. You know, I view myself as very independent. I wasn't even in a frat. You know, I never was in any kind of clubs or anything like that. But when I was 29, I met an acquaintance who was, you know, Ivy educated guy, super smart, about my age, you know, attractive, charming, good guy, you know, you totally like him. You know, he worked as a bartender while he was going to Columbia at night. You know, he showed great interest in talking to me because my band played there and we chatted and this and that. And these long conversations at the bar during my breaks turned into more deeper conversations about the meaning of life and philosophy and stuff that I love talking about because I was a philosophy major. Eventually, he started asking to meet me and have meetings and talk about myself. And I was suspicious. I didn't know if he was like coming on to me or what was going on.
You said he was kind of like a stalker, right? Is this the same guy that it kind of felt like he was stalking you a little bit?
It did. Yeah, it did feel like stalking. I didn't like it because it just wasn't cool. And he was like just showing up like at weird places and weird times to like meet with me. It was just unusual. One evening, he asked to meet me and talk. He said he had something very important to tell me. And so I met him in a bar downtown. I'm 29 again, and he's about my age. And this is 1989, and we sit down in this bar, and I said, okay, so what's the thing? Are you about to come out to me? It's like, what is going on? And he said, no, I'm not. You know, I'm involved in something that's very secretive and very private, and it's an esoteric school, and just want to offer you the opportunity to attend it. We study Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and it's very special. A lot of people who are very smart like you, I think you'll love it, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, no thanks, it's a cult. And I said, don't bother me anymore about it. But I felt bad for saying that, and I figured I'd give it a shot and find out more about it because I felt guilty for turning him down, really.
Well, did he seem hurt or offended when you said that? Is that why you felt guilty? Yeah.
He did.
Oh, yeah. You know, people have asked, was that an act? I don't think so. I think he was offended genuinely. And I think I, as, you know, Jewish neurotic type of person, felt very guilty.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to give him another chance. So he said, let's meet somebody else from the group and then you could ask more questions. And then if you want, you can come. It meets twice a week. You have to commit to come for a month, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, fine. So
I'm gonna pause you. I just want to pause you for a second. Just like, let's talk about some of this stuff. So first of all, I just want to note that like coming from someone who you've, you know, sort of forged this intellectual connection with is different from just like a random person on the street just coming up to you and being like, come to this thing. It's like, no, you've talked about philosophy. He's obviously academic and very curious and interested. And like, you've developed this connection already. So by the time he approaches you for this thing, I imagine there's a little bit of trust built up between you. Would you say?
Absolutely. That is the key aspect here, that I did have some trust in him. And I otherwise would not have pursued it if he didn't look like someone who was like me, frankly.
Yeah.
And acted like me.
Yeah. I also just always think it's so important to note that extremely educated people join these groups. This is not a thing that has nothing to do with our like intellectual capacity. And if anything, it just means we're more curious, more interested we are in learning about things.
I also think that there's this phenomenon that happens where once you reach a certain point in your life and you're still not happy, you still need more meaning, you know? So if you are super educated, you do have the great job, you are with the people and the whatever, and you're like, what the hell does this all mean?
Yeah.
You can sometimes get sucked into things.
Yeah. Well, and I, as someone who, you know, I think my grandpa, like some of my family were Masons. And for me, like just the idea of like a secretive group that has this long history or whatever, and maybe has some kind of esoteric knowledge, like so appealing, regardless of whether you have a void or you're searching or anything. I think it's just inherently appealing, the idea that like
powerful intellectuals secretly meet and learn together and share knowledge. Like, there's something just so cinematic about that. You know, like, it would be intriguing to anyone, I think.
Yeah. You know in the beginning of the movie that the guy's going to super get fucked, but he's going to go anyway. You know,
you're like, well, I would do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Or am I not going to go?
Exactly, yeah.
Bruce is who we're calling him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bruce also introduces you to, like, a beautiful lady, right?
Yeah. Bruce knew my number. I mean, you know, first of all, Bruce and the lady he introduced me, I should say, not to give too much away, but they were both two of the best recruiters for the cult. Bruce was extremely handsome. The lady he introduced me to, Heather, was extremely beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they had this intense, like, you know, these knowing looks at each other. I mean, they weren't like physical, like you didn't think they were like screwing each other, but you weren't quite sure.
Right.
I mean,
they might have
been, but that whole intrigue was really intense. And they had this real bond, and they talked about meaning and what do you really want in your life, and things that you wouldn't talk to about to strangers, although you might, you know, that sort of, you meet somebody in the airport, ever stuck on a plane with anybody, and you know, maybe you kind of like them a little bit and you chat and you open up about your whole life and then you'll never see them again. But this was just like that, except I was going to see them again. So there were two things that hooked out that relate to exactly what you've both said, which is the intellectual curiosity that I had and this sort of secret society seemed like, wow, that's really cool. If they had told me it was Est or Hare Krishna or something new, I don't know if I would have been to it. But the fact that it was like ancient, like Pythagoras and stuff like that, I'm like, shit, you know, this sounds cool. And she was beautiful. You know, it's like, okay, maybe there's some more like her there.
Yeah. At the end of our shows, we'll usually talk about whether we feel like that would be a cult that we would join. And I feel like this is absolutely the kind that I would join. You got hot people talking smart stuff. They're like Ivy League people. Like, this is my shit. Like, I would be all about this.
Well, I think you might get to a meeting, but then the question is, will you stay?
Right.
And that's really the big question.
Well, tell us about that next phase. So what happens when you go to this first meeting? What was it like?
It was very disappointing. I mean, you know, there was all this intrigue and cloak and dagger, and he didn't even tell me where we were going. He didn't give me the address. It was like, what? You know, that sounds cool. He's taking me to some secret hideaway, but it was just like a loft above a fabric store on Lower Broadway. It was like all boarded up. It was like, what? And then I go upstairs and there's a bunch of white people like me. And it looks really boring. I mean, there was nobody chanting or anything like that, which was fine, but you know, it just seemed all very plain vanilla. And the conversation was actually dull. I didn't understand what they were talking about. They didn't make any effort to let us in. But they did tell us, like, all of these, like, rules. I mean, the main rule is, like, Fight Club. That's the first rule of Fight Club, is you don't talk about Fight Club. And the second rule is you don't talk about Fight Club. And this was impressed upon me deep, heavy duty. So I wasn't impressed. I wasn't inclined to return. And yet I did. And it had to do with this crisis that I faced. Should I get into that? Or do you want to?
Yeah, please.
You could interrupt whenever you want. I mean,
no, I want the crisis. Totally. Tell us the crisis.
Yeah, give us the crisis. I'm probably going through it too. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. So that's the thing. I mean, we would have gotten you ladies in the door. Were you having a crisis? Maybe you were looking for something. I was not looking for anything. I had no interest in anything spiritual. I had enough friends. It was interesting, but I had a crisis. I was 29 and I lost my job. I was like, what? Why is this happening? You know, it was very upsetting to me. I'm a lawyer, you know, I had stability, but my firm was closing. So I went into the group and I talked about it to the leaders and the rest of the students. It was kind of like a group therapy kind of session. That's really kind of what it was, you know. And they were so encouraging and so supportive and sympathetic to the situation that they made me feel like, you know, like they loved me.
Right.
You know, and they really cared about my situation. I'd never heard people talk in the way they did to me. And it was like kind of just like the beginning of like falling in love with somebody.
Right.
And that began the descent.
Did you have like a close circle of friends prior to meeting this group? Yeah.
thank God. And they were there when I got out, thank God. But
wow.
Yeah. But, you know, it was like I told them about it, but these people were different.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because I think the thinking tends to be that there's like some gaping hole in our lives that leads us to join a cult.
Yeah, that's what I always think. But you're right. It can just be
like this situation is it like yeah. feels good right now. Mm-hmm. And that like that can be the extent of it. Like you had friends, you had a career, you know, even you did lose your job, but it seems like you pretty much had built a life for yourself. You're 29. You're not like a 18-year-old boy looking for identity or whatever. That's really interesting. And I think that in general, like people who are recruiters or members of these groups, in particular the leaders, are very skilled at generating those emotional experiences for people.
Like weaponized empathy.
Mm-hmm. Love bombing is all a part of that. I mean, it's like anything that makes us feel special or seen or heard or understood for the first time in a way that no one else has. I mean, that's just going to be intoxicating for pretty much everyone.
Yeah. I mean, there is that other aspect of like, okay, you're 29, you lost your job, go get another one. Like, what was it about it to you that felt so deep?
Well, it was like a failure, you right. know, along a long trajectory of hard work. And then this sudden thing, you know, there were other things that were going on in my life. My father had died a few years earlier. And I never really sort of mourned and had dealt with those issues.
Right.
You know, it's complicated. It's not cut and dry. You know, there's a lot of things. I mean, I definitely have things that might be some things in my life that let me open for it. You know, I don't know. But I refuse to blame myself anymore. I'll tell you that.
Sure.
Because they were con men, you yeah. know, and they were good at it. And it was really sophisticated.
Yeah.
And they got a lot of people in there who would never be involved. Obviously, no one wants to be involved in a cult, but, you know, most people there wouldn't be involved in like a club. You know, they're very independent people. They wouldn't go to like a book club. I don't think people would join a gym or anything. You know, I mean, seriously, like really not loners, but people who have like kind of like built in good lives. They like have families and mm-hmm. really good jobs. But I mean, there's so much to talk about the philosophy of it. I mean, we could spend days and I'm happy yeah. to do that. But wow. I don't know how much more I need to say yeah. about that. You ladies seem to have a very good understanding of it from your own personal lives and the many. I mean, you're both experts in it. So well, that's why it's exciting to talk to you.
It's why it's exciting to talk to you. Okay. So you have this meeting where you feel seen and you're like, oh, they're empathizing with me. And if you're feeling understood. What then happens? Like, what does daily life look like as you kind of begin to become deeper in it?
Well, I continued to go and I continued to pay and I continued to keep it secret and I continued to only see these people and talk to these people only at these twice a week meetings. So like you didn't go out on dates with anybody there or, you know, there was this rule of no fraternizing and there was no information about this group whatsoever. There was no flyers. They had no reading material. The teachers, they called themselves teachers, didn't have any last names. Mm. And there was something else they didn't have in 1989. There was no internet.
Right.
So there was really nothing there. And it was kind of cool, I guess, in a way. But you know, the day-to-day life of going to work, then going to meetings and reading what they had given us to read, talking about the readings, and then talking about our personal lives in class, working on the ideas of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, which were interesting. And it was just kind of like starting to lead a secret life that was kind of exciting.
Can you tell us about what some of the beliefs were and who those philosophers are?
Yeah, those unpronounceable philosophers, Gurdjieff and Uspensky, you know who knows them, like a lot of people who were like my age and hanging out in the 60s or older than me and were reading, you know, spiritual things in the 60s and 70s. This whole group, by the way, started in California and San Francisco. Mm. But in any event, Gurdjieff and Uspensky, they had something called the Fourth Way. And their whole spiel was that there are different ways of man to evolve through consciousness raising activities. So there's the way of the monk, which is religious, the way of the fakir, which is physical, and then the way of the something else, I can't remember. And then there's the fourth way, which was their new, brand new fourth way that they came up with. And they said it existed since Pythagoras. And basically, the concept is that man is asleep. And in order to awaken, you need to belong to an esoteric school and use the ideas of the so-called work. And there's a bunch of tools that they use that they say that were based on cosmic principles and things like relaxing and their Big Mac, you know, like McDonald's has the Big Mac. Like the work had this thing called self-remembering.
I'm already in. I'm in. I want to do it. What is it?
You want to do it?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Good question. So I'll tell you exactly what they said to me. Okay. What's the question? What is self-remembering, right? Mm-hmm. That's the question. Okay. The answer that the leader gave us was it's when you remember yourself.
Okay.
Your true self.
Like a past life self?
It's when I'm going to continue to play.
Be like them. Yeah, yeah.
Leader, okay. I'll keep going. It's when you remember yourself.
And they just say that until you're like, ah, yes.
Yes.
That's deep, right?
Yes. That's exactly what they did. And you keep going and it's a game and it's, you know, people, the class starts to laugh and then he's seriously repeating the same thing over and over again.
Wow.
More emphatically putting his hand on his heart. And then we were not getting anywhere, but some of the older senior group people in the group were going, ah, yes, you know, and so as younger people are like going, shit, maybe they know something we don't know. And then by the end of it, you're convinced there's something there that you just don't know. Like you didn't do the homework that day, but you better pretend you know it.
What a fascinating tactic. It's like reading meaning into anything. You're like, okay, if I think hard enough about it, yes, I think you can completely subjectively decide what the meaning is. But then when everyone else around you also is like, aha, there's this pressure to be like, right, yes, of course, you remember yourself, you know, like that would be.
It reminds me of that Buddha story where the Buddha held up a flower and everybody was looking at it. And then finally the young disciples started laughing and I've always been like, what the hell happened?
It reminds me of The Emperor's New Clothes.
And no, that too.
Also.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, but I just remember always reading that story when I would look into Buddhism things. And they never told you what he saw. You had to see what he saw. And so who knows?
Which is like, it can feel deep because you can apply literally anything from your life experience to it. From your understanding at this point, who is the one who's sort of spearheading bringing these beliefs to all of you? Do you know, are you aware of who the leader is? Like, what do you know about this at that point?
No. Well, yeah, we did. We had a few different teachers. We were like in our early 30s, most of us, and the leaders were like in their mid 40s. So they seemed really old to us. And, in about a year later, even older woman showed up one day and we were told that she was our teacher's teacher and she was our teacher as well. And that was Sharon Gans. There was no internet again, so we didn't know her last name. She was just introduced to Sharon. I thought she was nuts. I was not happy to see her because I liked the people who were already leading, and they were like in love with her, scuttling around the room. They couldn't do enough for her, pouring her drinks and lighting her cigarette and just carrying on. And she was a very strange woman.
Was it a surprise when she showed up or you knew about her beforehand and you're like, here she is?
Oh, yeah, no, she just arrived. It was a surprise.
Oh, wow.
There were always surprises. Yeah, there were always surprises. There were always secrets in the group. They kept information very limited and we kind of liked that. So it was kind of fun to have surprises.
What was so intriguing about her? I mean, obviously she's a narcissist, so that'll do it a lot of the time. But what else? What was it about her?
Well, she came in that night and she was talking about sex, which was something we weren't talking about at all. And she supposedly had this great knowledge about, you know, conscious love and sex. And, you know, that all sounds really good. I mean, that's interesting. Although she kind of talked like a sailor and it didn't really register for anybody. And she made some strange comments about being, you know, at a very high level of consciousness. But when she came back the next time and everybody was frightened of her, you know, her resemblance, she had a very odd look about her, you know, very dyed red hair piled up on top of her head, this very regal manner. She looked like a medieval queen. I mean, she tried to look like she was in a Shakespeare period piece. It was just bizarre.
Was she dressed in like old-fashioned clothing?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, she wore like this big, odd, billowy dress with the gaudy jewelry and big earrings.
Wow.
And flowing down to the floor. She had on sunglasses. And this is all very, you can tell it's very expensive clothing.
They love sunglasses. And they always wear sunglasses. Okay.
She had sunglasses and she was wearing high top Converse sneakers.
Well, the look is iconic, I have to admit.
I know. I'm like, I need to do a book just on cult leader fashion. Yeah. This is so interesting.
As far as the look goes, I do think she nailed it. But
were you struck by her charisma, though? Or was it more just that everyone else was behaving as though she was special?
Yeah, it was more of other people were behaving. But most of us did not react well to her. The eldest, more senior people were very much enthralled by her. We all respected them. And so it was just like self-remembering, like, what the fuck is that? It's the same situation. But she did earn her adulation from the rest of us, because while she could be quite evil and shameless, she could dispense, you know, advice that seemed really good and very loving and so dramatic. And just wise, you know, like this sort of wise woman who you kind of wish your mother said. I mean, you don't wish her for your mother, believe me, but like your mother dispensed really great advice and took you under and just always really motherly and but brilliant. I mean, she was really well spoken, had no really good education, but very well read and very convincing in all of her advice.
Mm. You know what I just realized? It's not like you can go afterwards and talk to one of the people in it. Like, that lady was weird, because you're not really supposed to talk outside of it, huh?
That's right. So after class, we had this thing called an hour of silence. We weren't allowed to, like, compare notes.
Brilliant.
Because we all had to be some.
That is so smart.
This is all figured out.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, so you didn't know.
You can't talk to anyone for that hour. Is it literal, like, I have to go
Nobody.
Be silent for an hour? Wow. Okay.
You go home and, you know, you don't talk for an hour. I mean, I didn't want to tell the cab driver where it was going. It was like sign language, like down there, you know, it was like crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a way to turn off your ability to process your experiences.
It was exactly pitched as a way to process your experience by letting the night and the evening, you know, really dig into you and digest it.
And if you saw someone from class out in the world.
Yeah, did that ever happen? Did you guys have to pretend you didn't know each other?
Yeah, is it a Fight Club situation?
Fight Club. I saw people on the subway, maybe almost barely a nod, or just look the other way. There's no talking. There's no nothing. And then maybe if you saw them in class, you'd say, hey, that was great to see you. You look great. You look like you were remembering yourself.
This is the first I've heard of a cult doing this, like not letting its members talk outside of the meetings.
It's so
and
smart.
And it's brilliant. Yeah, it's
so
brilliant.
Smart.
How do cult leaders lose their power? Well, when the members start talking to each other and start sharing stories and sharing their doubts.
That was weird. What about when she said that?
Yeah.
Why is she so blah, 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 blah?
Right.
Nothing. No
genius
processing.
Way to keep people completely isolated and completely unable to think about whether something that they experienced was normal and healthy.
Especially in the early years, that was very strict about the non-fraternization. Later on, it was loosened a little bit. Mm. But by then, everybody was tattling on everybody if they ever said anything nasty. Look, if you expressed your doubts, you were encouraged to come in to class, or we privately expressed our doubts and we were immediately told to disavow them. Like, oh, yeah, of course you think it's a cult. Ha ha ha. No.
LOL.
You crazy?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so funny how many people who were in cults joked about it being a cult were in the cult.
Yeah, you have to. You absolutely have to.
And even recognized it in the beginning like you did. And then still we're like, oh, this is probably a cult, but it's fine.
Yeah. Can you believe people think we're a cult? I mean, obviously they would think that because we're doing such amazing things and working so deeply and whatever.
Or like, it's fine. It's a happy cult. It's a positive cult. So if we're a cult, I don't care.
Yeah. If we're a cult, I want to be in a cult.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, she said that a couple times. She even said that.
Really?
Know. call it a cult. Call it whatever you want.
Right. Tricky, tricky. I mean, that would work. I mean, that's like totally fair. We talk about that too. It's like there are groups that like technically seem culty, but like as long as they're not doing any harm, who cares? You know, so it's really about recognizing that harm. And actually, great segue, Lola, because let's talk about the harm.
Yeah, I actually have a question. Like you said you had to give money every week. What kind of money are we talking?
Yeah, like, okay, so we gave $300 a month. You know, it went up for some people. Some people were paying $5. By the time I left, I was not only paying that $300, but I was paying other fees to them. And let's say one thing about the harm. I never thought any of this was harmful. Mm. Not one thing.
Wow.
For 23 years, I thought it was all for my own good. And even after I left, it took me years and a lot of therapy and a lot of good luck and good friends to start realizing that there was a lot of harm. Yeah. And it was harmful from day one. The disgusting, outrageous treatment and lies that this group perpetuates on good people, good willing, good natured people who had ruined lives. Yeah. You know, nobody talks about this group. There have been hundreds, thousands of people who've come and gone through this group, and nobody has talked publicly about it.
Wow.
Or written publicly about it. There's one other blogger, but that's it. And they're still out there. They're doing this. Sharon died, but they're still doing this group, but they're still going on.
Unbelievable.
So what are the other harmful things you wanted to know?
Yeah, I mean,
didn't realize was harmful?
She started controlling people's lives, right? Like, what was she doing? How did that happen?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So yeah, right. Well, we were encouraged to come in and ask for advice, you know, so-called apply the ideas to our lives. If you weren't married, you wanted to be married or find somebody, or, you know, you wanted to make more money, and, you know, everybody wants something. And it was, those were the main things that we talked about that people cared about. People also cared about like their families and whatnot. And Sharon would opine on all of these things, and the kinds of things that she opined on, she had no qualifications. But I mean, just to give some examples, like she would encourage people to have affairs with other people in the group.
Wow.
She would tell women, you know, it happened on more than one occasion. And again, this didn't happen in the first year of her being there. This is long, you know, progressively gets worse.
Yeah.
And I try to take my reader in the book in through that journey so you can really see why, oh, that could happen. Oh, yeah, maybe that could happen. Or the reader will start cringing because they know where this is going, and that each red flag becomes darker and darker and redder and redder for them.
Yeah.
You know, me and the others are just getting more fucked over.
That's such an important point because – yeah, if they were to start just doling out abusive practices immediately, like everyone would leave. That's not how it works. It's a, like doing a small thing and then you adjust to that reality. And then from there you can do a slightly bigger thing because you've adjusted to the first reality, you know, and this is this gradual process over time.
The fallacy of sunken costs.
Yeah.
That's also a very big aspect of it. Yeah.
Definitely. Eventually it got to the point where she's like meddling with everyone's like personal lives, family lives, and financial lives. Did you
sex lives,
telling people they couldn't be gay, right? She wanted gay men to marry women.
She did. Yeah. There was a lot of, this, she believed in, you know, gay conversion, which of course does not exist.
Right.
But then and now there are a lot of men and women who are gay, who, you know, they can't quite accept that about themselves, and that's very understandable in a society like ours.
Right.
When those people came, kind of like people like that who had ambivalence about their lives, she would say, oh, no, you can straighten out, so to speak. And she married off, you know, a gay man to her daughter. She had no problem doing that. And there was one man who was married off to at least two different women. You know, I'm aware of at least four marriages like that.
Do you think that she believed she was doing something good?
Absolutely.
It's very...
She said she had no regrets.
Really? I mean, well, yeah, I heard that makes say sense. That. It really reeks of Teal Swan to me in a lot of ways, because I think that Teal Swan is – my impression of her is that she – do you know who she is?
Yeah, I've heard the name, but
– she's like a social media guru who claims that she has psychic powers. And even though there was a whole podcast about her, you know, one of her followers who she advised killed herself. Yeah. But even though she was sort of exposed, she's still like had this resurgence on TikTok where she's like kind of in this group of self-help people and people take her advice seriously. But we went to one of her like workshops. She would like use her psychic powers in quotation marks to select people from the audience, bring them on stage, and then fully tell them what to do with their lives. Not like
suggestion,
but like, this is what you need to do, including someone who had just gotten out of a cult themselves and was looking for guidance. And she was just basically like, this is what you have to do. And of course, she's not qualified. She's not a therapist. She's not a medical professional. But I get the sense, and I could be wrong, I get the sense that she doesn't believe that she's malicious. Like my old prophet, actually, you know, he knew what he was doing was just to get off on it, basically. But for someone like her, I really feel like
she thinks she's doing good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just like the power of it.
She got off. She loved that. Mm. She loved the power.
It's probably both, right?
Did she think it was good? I guess I wonder about that. It's a good question. I ought to think about it some more. I might. But she was mostly driven by money and power, with a certain kind of gratification, power and controlling people's lives, and a particular kind of person, you know, successful people and, you know, people who were in vulnerable spots.
The money point is a really important one, because most of the people involved in this group are successful.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, a lot of business owners, small owners, you know, Wall Street people. You know, there were several lawyers, there's a few doctors, but, you know, we were the poor ones. I mean, there was an heiress, there was a couple of heiresses there. There were some rich people there, and there were some people who weren't, but she really was very good at getting some of these people to give her fortunes. And just, you know, the monthly numbers added up to about $1 million in cash every year.
Wow. And this is the early 90s, right? Early 90s million.
Throughout. I don't know how much they make now, but it's a lot. And it's all cash.
Cash, wow.
And she had an extensive real estate thing. I mean, all that stuff I found out after I left. I didn't investigate any of it while I was there.
She would also have people commit tax fraud. Is that correct?
Yeah, again, yeah, that's at the end of the book I explained. Because the reason I explained at the end is because I didn't know about it. But yeah, she had this whole very elaborate money laundering scheme, which, you know, was like a drug dealer or the mafia would do.
Wow.
It involved real estate and piles of cash and bags of cash.
Oh my gosh.
You know, being shipped around in the middle of the night in Manhattan. It was,
wow,
you know.
This is exciting.
Thing.
She's especially fascinating because it's normally men who are doing this.
I know.
Especially that like level of lavish taking people's money.
You said that there was something sexual in this for her. What was that?
Yeah. I mean, you said getting off on it. She got off on things in a sexual way by controlling people, watching people suffer. Yeah. She was sadistic. Mm. She liked to humiliate people to a pulp. And she got off on it, and it made her feel better. She would do that to very loyal people also and berate them.
Mm.
And people who were considered the leaders in the group above us, you know, the rank and file, when she dug into them, you could just tell she got off on it. And, you know, she may have been having sex with some of the people there. She did have a husband who was a predator in the group, and I think some of the other leaders were as well. There's so much we don't know yet still about this group. There's so much we don't know.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be very curious to see everything that comes out. I was shocked that she only died last year.
Yeah, she died last year. She bequeathed her interest in the company. They have an LLC that runs the company, and it runs the cult, and it's extremely secretive. Nobody even if you're in the group, you don't know what it's called. They call it Study now. They disavow any knowledge of Sharon, even if anybody would know. And they call themselves the Study, like I said, and they are actively recruiting people. And they have an upstate farm where they send people to work on weekends. And they're
really sounds like they're getting,
you know,
murdered.
Yeah,
like
my
that.
God.
the farm upstate.
Yeah.
They're doing like manual labor.
Yes. Yeah. Manual labor. People pay for the privilege to do manual labor.
Wow.
And they're still collecting cash. There have been a number of people who've gotten out of the group since my book came out. And the publicity about it, there's a lot of publicity about it in the city. And the Post particularly loves cults, and they're running with it. And it's great because people are seeing it and are getting out. And, you know, that's good. We want
that. Yeah. Well, can you tell us how and when you yourself began to doubt? Like, what were the red flags that you saw?
You're 23. That was different than you're 22.
Right. I mean, the red flags had been going on for a while. I think halfway through the group of my 23 years there, I realized, you know, this was not so good. But I tried to make the best of it because, you know, I had a marriage with somebody in the group. I didn't want to lose that marriage because I knew if I left, that would have meant that the marriage would be over. Mm. Also, I had business ties there. But once my marriage was over on its own, there were other just shocking things with Sharon that she had done to me and to others that just led me to a place where I was basically having a nervous breakdown. And I just met a woman who was like that stranger on the airplane kind of thing, you know, where you tell your whole life to. I did, and told her about this. I'd never told her anybody about the cult. And once I sort of let it out, it became clear, you know, that this was not a good place. And I got out.
Wow.
That's so cool.
It's amazing just the power of like verbalizing something that's been living in your body. Like just hearing it out loud or even just journaling.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is bad actually.
Were you literally on an airplane or where was this woman?
She was a flight attendant. We flew back from Seattle to New York. And I immediately fell in love with her when I saw her on the plane.
Oh, my God.
She was so, yeah. We kept in touch, and then we got together, and we went to the beach, and we just – it was in the winter, and we talked – you know, we talked, and we had a very nice – it was short but very sweet and very profound relationship, and I keep in touch with her from time to time. She also – when I met her, she said that I should write a book about it.
Wow. What an important – relationship. What an important transition in your life.
I mean,
yeah, it was really nice. Yeah, those things happen. You know, those things can happen.
Power of speaking, the power of connection with another person who's not a part of the thing. Like, they're so powerful. When you left, I mean, was it like a thing? Was there retaliation? Like, what was that experience like?
Well, yes, there was retaliation in the sense that all my ties with my business were over and I lost all of my income. And, you know, what they said would happen to me happened to me. You know, you'd be cut off, you'd be cast out. And mentally, I was a wreck because I thought I lost everything. I had no self-dignity or ability to discern anything for myself. I mean, I was 52. It was like a, you know, worse than a, I mean, an infant had more self-dignity than I did. It was really a mess. And I had a family. I have a son. It wasn't like they came after me so much as it was just, I was like infected with
just
this
dropped.
Like awful disease.
Mm.
Yeah, I had like this. My mind was a wreck. But in terms of them coming after me, no. It's been the other way around. I've been, you know, going after them in the sense of telling the story. That's going after them. That reveals the dark secrets, and that's the best disinfectant.
Totally. Can you describe how you have healed?
Yeah, you said.
Well, I will say this, that both of you, you could probably recruit me to whatever you have because you both listen so intently and seem, I mean, you've talked to a lot of people about cults, but I feel like I was in the best cult of all time. You're making me feel that way. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, if you sign up for our month-long course, you can experience more of this.
You said something about like some things started to unlock you. You said like I got into therapy and some things got unlocked, and I want things in my own life to be unlocked. I just feel like you are such an amazing person of healing, and I still have stuff that I want to do, you know?
You want to join my cult?
I want to join your cult is what
we
I'm saying.
We're all going to join each other's
I want
cults,
to join
you
your cult because it feels like you've done a lot of work and a really, I don't
it
know.
It does. You yeah. do seem like you have a really healthy handle on everything now. So is that true or is that just a perception?
No, it's just a bullshit. I've learned a lot from those years in the cult. I have a great pitch. No, yeah, I'll tell you what I learned. I did a lot of therapy with a really great therapist who knew exactly and was just a right fit, who knew exactly what I needed, which was a lot of space and a lot of learning how to trust myself. And no matter what it was, to just really trust my impulses, and my instincts, and to stop being judgmental. And to, his big word was gentle and empathetic to myself.
That's a hard
that's
one.
Everything.
Yeah, just, a bunch of things. I talk about a lot of these things in the book about, you know, the key things. I could probably write more about it. And, you know, I'm just happier than I've ever been. And, you know, life is filled of crazy bad things will happen, you know, unexpected things will happen all the time. And it's just, that's the facts, you know? And so it's really just a matter of addressing all those things in a rational, calm way, if you can. And if you can't, that's okay too.
Well, bad things don't happen to Lola and I because our OCD compulsions keep us safe.
Oh, gosh.
It's true, yeah. As long as I obsessively check in to make sure I'm not going crazy, I don't go crazy.
The oven is off. I've checked 90 times.
Well, I have. Is that part of when I join your cult? Is like an OCD element to it?
There's a little bit of that. Yeah. Yeah. A little bit.
No, we're healing. We're healing it. We're healing it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to let me start rearranging things in my cult.
Wow. You are awesome. Thank you so much for talking to us. Is there anything that you feel like you want to add or communicate to listeners?
Well, your listeners are members of people who were in cults or know people who were a lot of survivors.
It's a mix. We have survivors and we just have interested listeners. Yeah.
Interested listeners. Well, I'll say to anyone, I mean, everyone's been in, survivors and, you know, everyone's had some trauma in their life and some difficult situations or impossible relationships that they're in and impossible things. So it's really tough.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing. And there is a human spirit of resilience and one can have freedom if nowhere else in your mind. And, there's also lots of places to get help. Like New York has this wellness line. I think it's NYC Wellness or something like that. But there are places you can get free, probably in California too. There's places to get help.
Wow.
Yeah. It's important for people to get professional mental health help.
I agree.
I do not believe in the self. You gotta get help. That's my feeling.
I agree with you.
And there's a lot of it out there.
Yeah. So. I also just want to point out that like your story is especially inspiring because I think, you know, for most of us, we're in a cult for like maybe through our childhood or like a few years. And you were a member for 23 years and you still got out in your 50s and you're thriving even after that long. I just think that's like incredibly impressive. Look at you.
Yeah. They had you too. They had you with the business, with the wife. They had you tight and you still, I mean, it's
they had me both. They had me with everything, every inch of me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been getting this asked a question about like what got me out. It was just, it's a lot. There's a lot. I really tried to write about all of the nuance and then write the facts and hopefully people can draw their own inferences and then, you know, illuminate me and, you know, illuminate themselves. I really want that. You know, that would be a great gift.
Well, we ordered the book. It's like one half yummy New York scene, other half huge realizations, and it's delicious. So can't wait.
Yummy and
yummy and delicious. I don't know. I love that kind of stuff.
It's a snack.
Yeah.
Manhattan Cult Story, my unbelievable true story of sex, crimes, chaos, and survival. Everybody go buy it. Are you on social media at all?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram, official Spencer Schneider. And I have a blog, which, you know, is somewhat interesting, Cult Revolt.
Love that name.
And then It's more than interesting. It's great. What am I talking about? And then that's pretty much the best way. And then I have my own website, Spencer-Schneider.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for talking to us. This has been really wonderful.
Yes,
okay, thank you. Well, he's so amazing. Love him. Megan, what do you think? Would you join school?
Yeah. I mean, it does sound horrifically boring, the actual classes part of it. And the like folding chairs would be a little triggering for me because that's how I was raised. And I was in an acting class that was led by a narcissist that we're actually going to interview a girl from soon that I did leave. And it was kind of similar, but the like severe secrecy and the like, I don't know, that would have been a little more intriguing to me, I think.
Yeah, same. I mean, I already said this in the episode, so I don't need to say it again, but I fucking love this shit.
Yeah, you would love this.
I'm on board.
I'm still scared you might join.
Honestly, same. Well, I might join Spencer's cult because he just is super cool and seems incredibly wise, but you know, remains to be seen.
Yeah, either one.
Okay, cool. Well, that's it then.
Good. Thank you so much for spending another week with us. We can't wait to see you here next time. Always remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never, ever
trust me.
Bye.
Bye.